I'm Afshin Ratansi and welcome to Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world from the heart of the Middle East, where Donald Trump has been positioning upwards of 65,000 US troops around Iran. French President Emmanuel Macron is in Cairo to discuss the Arab states' plan for Gaza as Trump continues to push an Israeli ethnic cleansing proposal to expel Gaza's population into Egypt and Jordan. All this amidst increasing reports of a crackdown on university students in the United States, hunted down and abducted in broad daylight for speaking out against Washington's complicity in Israel's genocide in Gaza. If scenes like these had played out in Iran, Russia or China, NATO nation media would be howling about dictatorship. Joining me again from London is a lifelong fighter for Palestinian rights, novelist, playwright, historian, filmmaker, journalist and street fighter. Tariq Ali has just published his second volume of memoirs, You Can't Please All, encompassing not only his own personal family history, but his work after his internationalist role in the 60s at the New Left Review. Tariq, thanks so much for coming back on the show. Obviously, I love your memoir. I'm even in the index. First time that's happened for a while, I think, somewhere between Reagan and something else. Just very briefly, I know lots of today's events actually are all linked to events in your memoir. Tell me how it came to pass. This second memoir, much bigger than Street Fighting Years, has come to pass.
It came about because I'd been under pressure from various people, especially some members of the family, to write a memoir of the second period. I was in two minds about it because it's very different from Street Fighting Years, which was a period of revolutionary upheavals. And the new memoirs are written at a time of counter-revolution, by and large, one has to say, with the United States dominating the globe, with capitalism and globalization wrecking one country in one continent after the other, etc. But I dug out various things for the book, including Palestine, my memories of that, my first trips to Palestine, to Beirut, to the refugee camps after the Six-Day War, and then what I've been saying about Gaza for the last 25 years. So I felt that I should record all that, and I have done, and I'm generally pleased with the outcome.
I should say there's so much more than just that, but of course this region, the whole world, is watching the images still, if they can, usually on social media, because the media in NATO countries is such propaganda. They're watching the images coming from the West Bank and Gaza. You saw the charred bodies of children in Vietnam. How does your experience of Vietnam and Palestine somehow give you some kind of hope amidst a time when, I mean, on Saturday's show, we talked to Dr. Mustafa Barghouti, like you, a friend of Edward Said. Why do you somehow have some hope, given that we can see the Holocaust in the Middle East?
The Vietnam was a time of hope. When I was in North Vietnam during the bombing, we were given regular briefings by senior North Vietnamese officers to explain what was going on, why they were doing what, where they were doing it. And they would end every meeting with, "Comrades, please do not worry. We're going to win this one." And seeing all the bombing, seeing children being decapitated, seeing young children without legs and arms, seeing the use of pellets and other forms of bombs to hit civilian men and women and children, you feel very depressed because we're not used to it. And the Vietnamese would say, "You will get used to it, please." And the horrific thing was that after 2 weeks, I did get used to it. I mean, it was upsetting, but you felt you were in a war. And you weren't sure whether what the Vietnamese were saying was just propaganda or whether they actually had a very clear-cut plan to isolate the United States, both inside Vietnam and outside, and win the war. And when I asked the North Vietnamese Prime Minister Pham Van Dong, I said, "Can we help? Can we bring international brigades to come and fight with you. It'd be a good. He said that would be good for propaganda, but of no real use at all. I'll be frank, he said, because the technology which the United States now has, no international brigade can resist it. And anyway, he said, our Chinese and Soviet comrades will be very angry, saying, what do you need international brigades for when we're there, we're helping, you know, etc. So I said, can't we do anything? He said, go and build mass movements. We need mass movements in Europe and especially the United States of America. So we did.
Maybe the US authorities, German authorities, French authorities have read your book then. Because what have you felt about the fact that they seem to realize the power of street mass mobilization? They're deporting students, they're arresting students. Even though these marches are, you know, they're large in the United States, but relatively small in Western Europe.
Except in Britain. They've been very big in Britain. And that's because we've had an anti-war movement since the occupation of Afghanistan after 9/11, and we built it. Iraq War, it grew. So people, a layer of people, young and old, were prepared to come out and did so in huge numbers. We've now had 27 big demonstrations in all in London. And the Labour government now, under Starmer and his gang, are trying to stop them, putting pressure, arresting people, drugging anti-war Jews into police stations. They did that to a guy who was in, actually a very old guy who'd been in one of the camps during the Second World War. They took him in just to sort of harass. Obviously, they let him go. So this harassment is starting here. People's computers are being spied on. People coming from Arab backgrounds, students are being threatened. One step out of line, you could be deported too. So the American way of doing things is now spreading to the United Kingdom. Of course, France and Germany have been a total disaster. In Germany, young Jews I've seen being beaten up for being on a pro-Palestinian march, leave alone the assaults on Palestinian students and other citizens. So it's a very strange situation we have now in Europe, where they don't seem to care about international law. The courts they set up themselves to try their enemies, they don't care. If they're used against them, like against this rogue Netanyahu, who is wanted, his allies don't care a damn. Israeli war criminals go in and out of the United States, go in and out of European countries. No one touches them. And I'm stressing all this, Afshan, because ultimately this will have some impact. You know, ultimately people will remember. And if the Israelis think they've got away with this for eternity, and they're going to join the Americans and Trump and make Gaza into a holiday center, it won't end like that. That's one phase.
Well, arguably, many people in the Global South always suspected that when it came to international courts and international justice in the first place. But if it's having that impact on British civic life and European civic life as regards freedom, your book is littered with examples of attempts to suppress freedom of speech. Remind us about a story early on in the memoir where you talk about jogging in a North London park, where you discover that Britain, even in the 1990s, we're not talking about the 1930s, 60s, is like...
This was evidence I was giving to a official government tribunal discussing police surveillance in the 60s and 70s. But then I recalled that this went on beyond that, because I was once walking in a park in North London and was stopped by someone who recognized me and said, are you Tariq? I said, yeah. And he said, I have to speak to you because you changed my wife's life. Now, when the husband says that to me, I get a bit nervous. But in this case, it was totally political. And he said, my wife for her sins, used to work at GCHQ, the big intelligence center in Cheltenham in the United Kingdom. And her task was to listen to your phone conversations in shifts. And she was on the evening shift. And you were breaking up with your partner, and your daughter was very upset. And you would read her stories every night, and she would cry. And, you know, my wife got very emotional. And the very next day, she went to her boss and said, I didn't think I was joining the intelligence service to spy on the private lives of others, and walked out, resigned. And that was when we got actual confirmation that they were spying. You know, what they accused the Stasi in East Germany of doing, they were doing themselves all over Europe, and including Britain. And this carried on. They admitted that this carried on. They publicly admitted this carried on till the Iraq war. So that's 50 years of spying. Now, of course, they can spy on everyone, so it's not a big deal. I mean, you know, the equipment they have, every citizen can be spied upon, because we all use computers, mobile phones, etc., etc.
Yeah, I mean, your mail was...
quite a shock still.
Your mail was bugged, and I suppose, as you intimate, you could have used the MI5 tapes to help you with the memoir, help jog your memory about events. So when we were working together for Channel 4, were our phones being bugged at the production company, at Bandung File, which is a primetime show, which you might want to talk about?
Yeah, of course. Must have been spied upon. And I have a few candidates in mind, but I, you know, will not repeat their names of people who were passing information on. And then something weird happened, that when we closed down Bandung and we had left many of our tapes to pack the next day, including outtakes, which we hadn't used, but which were very valuable, because we could have made larger films with them. I arrived the next morning with a large truck to have them stored, and half of them had disappeared.
And I should remind the audience, because, you know, there's very little on the web about Bandung File, named after the Sukarno non-aligned conference in Indonesia. Was a prime time. There was a time when primetime documentary series like that were on. But we'll have to go to a break now, Tariq. I'll stop you there. More from Tariq after this break. Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with the longtime editorial committee member of the New Left Review and author of the memoir You Can't Please All, Tariq Ali. Tariq, we were talking about Bandung File. There was a time when television, even on terrestrial TV, people would watch and be able to learn about the world. So I better actually ask you, because the biggest issue in the world is arguably the possibility of a Trump war on Iran. And clearly, they're not going to get the news from Bandung File or any kind of progressive television to tell them about the context of what a Trump attack would be like, what its consequences would be. What's your take on all these tens of thousands of troops and all the multi-billion dollars of weaponry being poured in here to this region?
With Trump, it's always difficult to tell whether what he is threatening is a serious threat, or whether he is using it as a negotiating ploy. For instance, I mean, before we discuss Iran very briefly, on Ukraine, are the United States, which have been backing this war, arming the Ukrainians, wrecked and rigged the 2014 elections, and been centrally involved in provoking the Russians, are they now going to force their people to sit down round the table and push through a negotiated settlement where both sides will have to make concessions? We don't know. We'll see. At least it's said so. On Iran, my own feeling is that it would be a very rash president and leadership of the Pentagon that decided to either themselves or to unleash the Israelis on Iran. Iran is going to fight back. They know what's going on. They've had discussions with other large countries. The main purpose for destabilizing Iran is to get concessions from them. And the concessions are not simply on nuclear reactors and all that. I think there's a more serious plan, which is to make it impossible for Iran, as a sovereign state, to negotiate directly and sell oil and gas to China. They would like the US to be the power that determines to whom energy is sold and under what conditions. And it's part of their big plan to surround and lay siege to China, about which all of them are serious, not just Trump, but, you know, Biden before him, Obama before that, Bush, etc. They are worried and concerned about the development of China as a major economic power, and they want to control it. So, in my opinion, the threats against Iran are more to do with that than anything else. Of course, the Israelis want to destroy all the countries that are still sovereign states. They've done it in the heart of the Arab world. They would like to do it to Iran, but it's not going to be so easy. The second thing on this, Afshan, is that the Iranian clerical leadership has already made concessions to its own population. I mean, I've been speaking to Iranian friends here and some who've come back from Iran in recent weeks, and they say that the law with the prohibitions on women and how they dress has been suspended, that you can take a walk through Tehran and it's like walking through parts of Beirut. So they realize some of the big mistakes they've made for no real rhyme or reason, just in my opinion, pure stupidity to try and insist that this is the way you can control your country. But so they're aware of that. And the population, while the middle and upper middle classes loathe the regime, even they don't want their cities to be reduced to what Gaza has been reduced to, or what Beirut has been reduced to, or what Damascus and Aleppo are being reduced to. They don't want that. They may want to get rid of their regime, but they don't want a foreign invasion. And there, within the country as a whole, despite, you know, anger with the regime on many fronts, people will fight back. The Pasdaran is well organized. They're not going to go under. The Iranians have air force. They have missiles, non-nuclear missiles.
No asymmetric attacks on Western European suppliers of the weaponry that Israel would rain down on Iran?
These West European countries and the United States who've been supplying weapons to Israel are doing so largely to make sure that the Israelis carry on fighting when they're needed to. They've gone a bit out of control, which is why some people in the United States even are nervous. But by and large, the weapons are not going to be used, or they could be, but were not supplied to attack Iran, in my opinion. I think both the United States and the European powers are divided on Iran. The Germans, for instance, have had good relations with Iran before October 2023. So it's an open question of how they will react, but it won't be an easy war for the West to win, in my opinion, if they go for Iran.
You said unprovoked Russian entry into Ukraine earlier. As you know, in Britain on the media, you're not allowed to say that. You're not allowed to say that it was provoked. So actually, just very briefly, when it comes to what's happening in Ukraine, where Western Europe seems an outlier. The entire international community doesn't understand Western European attempts at World War III. Why was Yugoslavia such a litmus test at the New Left Review, where you're on the board? Because it was amazing that people didn't understand, on the left, the importance of the NATO attack on Yugoslavia, and perhaps that set the fertile ground for this proxy war that may have cost the lives of a million Ukrainians.
Well, the New Left Review was very strongly anti-NATO on the question of Yugoslavia. I mean, I wrote about it, others did. I actually edited a book on the former Yugoslavia, anti-NATO book. And recently, a year or so ago, we produced a new book explaining NATO's role by one of our younger colleagues, Gray Anderson, who lives in the States, on NATO. The line on the Ukraine is fairly clear, that there are many different aspects to the war. The principal cause of it is two: A, the failure of the Russian leadership during the Gorbachev period to force a treaty in which they were given a written assurance that NATO, they were given a verbal assurance, not one step eastwards will NATO take. And there's a book by an American academic giving all the facts and figures on this. But they did not sign a treaty, as happens after every major event. And the collapse of the Soviet Union and breaking up of the country was a very big event. In return, they got nothing except more trouble from the West. Gorbachev later denied it. He said, we got assurances. Yeah, we got assurances, but not written assurances that could be taken.
You show quite clearly the kind of, well, I think many Russians will see as insane actions of Gorbachev. It certainly cost the lives of millions of Russians in terms of lower life expectancy. Running out of time, there's so much clearly in this book. It could be like a six-hour film. One element that seemed to be new to me, I met Hugo Chavez once at the UN Millennium Summit in New York. He became a friend of yours. Just explain why there is some evidence, perhaps, and you say in your book about it, that his cancer was not naturally occurring, and that Hugo Chavez, the one of the great leaders of the Global South, could well have been targeted in an assassination.
He felt that himself. He said that in his last months before he died to a group of intimates, including the current president, Maduro. He said, you know, I feel some dirty business has gone on. And he even named the person who he thought had been responsible, who, an American lady who he had a brief fling with. I mean, he wasn't married or anything, you know, and she disappeared suddenly. We don't know where she went. The Venezuelan intelligence couldn't track her down. And I consulted a very top physician and surgeon who works for the World Health Organization, an American. And I said, is it possible to inject someone or somehow get them cancer? She said, I'd have to see the x-rays, but yeah, it is possible. Nothing is impossible now. So, you know, it was his own feeling, and many of us felt, because, you know, there was no history of cancer on any side of his family, and suddenly it hit him. So, and the Cubans were always very nervous about him being toppled in this way. They thought, I remember talking to senior Cubans, and they said, we don't think they're going to shoot him dead or, you know, give him poison cigars or things like that, but they will try a more subtle method. So the answer on that option is, I don't know. But it's my very strong instinct that given that he was found to be extremely troublesome by the United States, that the CIA has a record of bumping off heads of states or targeting them, Why shouldn't they do it to him? There's nothing else, you know, particularly sort of. They didn't fear anyone if they did it, but of course they didn't announce it. Because had it come out that it was the United States, there would have been clashes throughout the continent. So we don't know, but it's my feeling. And that's what I know.
Just finally, I know I wanted to talk to you about your friendship with Edward Said, what he would have thought of the genocide and so on. There's so many different issues. Let's just pick on one, because Trump is obsessed by Korea, or was in his first term, because North Korea arguably could destroy Los Angeles in 30 minutes. Just very briefly, you see the US role there desperately to prevent Northern and Southern Korea, North and South Korea from uniting. That is their fear.
Why are they trying to prevent the unity of the Koreas? It's a very straightforward reason, actually, and it was given to me by one of Donald Rumsfeld's advisors, legal advisors at the Pentagon. I was debating her, funnily enough, in Berlin. And while in public she was very gung-ho for all their wars, in private over lunch, I said,